Oh, it is a pleasure to introduce Dave to you. He has been a workhorse in the state of North Carolina for many, many years, and still is. And as I said, served as state delegate from his state on panel 17, and later was elected to Southeastern Regional Trustee, and his efforts for the Southeast and the country as a whole and AA as a whole was just as diligent as it was for the state of North Carolina. I'm privileged to know Dave, privileged to introduce him, and you are going to be privileged to hear him. Let's welcome Dave C. from Raleigh, North Carolina.
I don't want to read your notes. I would thank you, Virgil. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the committee for extending me this invitation to be here to celebrate your 25th convention. And I have a friend that says that the Sunday morning speaker, his purpose is to get up and kind of clean up the mess. And that's not true this weekend, because ever since I've been here, I've enjoyed this weekend. Well, all of the speakers, I've known them for a number of years, and this has been kind of like homecoming. And it's a thrill to be here and be a part of this convention. And I've enjoyed every minute of it up to right now. And I look around the room this morning, and I see a lot of people that I've known for many, many years. And this is good. A lot of people had a lot to do with my sobriety. And I'm no different from anybody else that gets up here. I'm a little bit nervous. And by the way, I appreciate the committee for... You know, you go to so many of these things when you're asked to, and they have a lot of these speakers, and two and three speakers, some of these meetings, and, you know, you can imagine how I feel this morning, I hope. I've been sitting here since Friday when I got here, getting ready, as Sandy says. And I started getting ready about 3 o'clock this morning, and I'm still getting ready, and it's a lot of apprehension. You sit here all the whole weekend, then you get up here and you want to cut your throat. And but always, it reminds me of a story that I've told many, many times, and I think it's appropriate again. Back in my part of the country, they tell a story of a convention they had many years ago. And they had one of these long-winded speakers. There's some of them around, by the way, and this guy began to talk, and he began his talk on the 12 steps. And he talked about an hour on the 12 steps, then he got into the 12 traditions on another hour. And then in the third hour, he got into the 3 legacies. And gradually, the people began to leave. They will leave. I found it out one night. And and lo and behold, he just began to look around, and there wasn't but one person left, and he was sitting on the front row. He became disturbed, so he wound up his talk, ran down from the podium, grabbed the man by the hand, says, "I want to ask you one question. Everybody left but you. Why did you stay?" And he says, "Hell, I'm the next speaker." Well, I know how that is. I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Dave Cook. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I think is the finest group in the whole wide world. And if you don't think the same about your home group, I suggest maybe you need to find another group. But because of God's grace, and because this program works for me, through the help of some understanding sponsors that led me with a kind but firm hand, and through the love of a loving wife that I found as a result of this program, and through the help of many people just like you, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or any tablets since the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day was September the 12th, 1957. Now, I don't give my sobriety date to impress anybody. It impresses me sometimes, but I give my sobriety date for two reasons, and two reasons only. I came into AA in Roanoke, Virginia, in the old Central Group. And the second meeting I ever went to in Alcoholics Anonymous was one of these discussion meetings. They had 13 or 14 wicker chairs sitting in a circle. People had problems. They began to talk about the problems. And I began to wonder what I was going to say when it got to me, like anybody else would. And it finally got to me. And the man who was to become my first sponsor spoke up and told me what to say. He says, "Give your name and your sobriety date. That's all you are qualified to do." And as a matter of fact, after the meeting, he explained to me that that was all I was going to be qualified to do for the next year, was to give my name and my sobriety date. And the second reason, they had a saying in that group, if you got behind that podium, if you remember that group and you got behind that podium and you didn't give your sobriety date, you usually didn't have one. So I've been given my sobriety date. I've received many benefits from this program just like you. A lot of benefits that I call marginal benefits, such as a little peace of mind, some serenity, a lot of happiness, a few material things. But any time I start thinking or speaking of marginal benefits, I have to think of certain basics. And the basic benefit that I received from this program, beyond my sobriety had to come first, the basic benefit that I received is my sanity. My sanity. And today, as a sane alcoholic, I find now that I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to cheat or steal anymore. I don't have to lie anymore. And most important of all, I do not have to sober up anymore. And I didn't know that when I got here. And I don't know if you were like me or not. I didn't know this was a deal where you stop drinking forever. And that's what the thing is structured for. That's what Dr. Bob said. I lied a little when I got here, but I'm very grateful this morning to know that as long as I use these tools, that I do not have to sober up anymore. Now, drinking to me is something I've never understood since I was a kid. My father was an alcoholic. He died an alcoholic death. It led to a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And from the time I knew what liquor drinking was, I didn't think I'd ever have any problem with it because I'd promised my mother as a young kid, never be like my daddy. And that's something I don't understand even today. And I'm one of these rare people that went through life, came from the right side of the tracks, had everything that I needed growing up, and from the time I knew what it had done to my father and what it led to my home, I didn't ever think I'd have any problem with it. And I went off to school at a young age, 16 in college. And I was in this environment. And I began to want to do what the big boys were doing, and I got drunk my first time, my freshman year in college. And I had a good time drinking in college. And it led to bigger things, and I had a lot of fun in the beginning. I can look back now and see that not only when I first began to drink, the way I drank was dictated by my environment, the environment that I was in. And I think the same is true today in my sobriety. The type of sobriety I have is dictated by the environment that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember the first time I got drunk. I can remember the results. And I can remember the early drinking when I was in school with a bunch of fellows that had just come back from World War II. A lot older than I, knew how to drink, and I was having trouble in the beginning getting it down and having those gagging exercises. And I heard them talk about the pleasure that comes from drinking, and I didn't understand what they were talking about because I was gagging most of the time. And one night I asked one of the fellows, I said, "When does the pleasure come that you speak of?" He says, "Dave," says, "if you remember, there's a little pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up, that's when the pleasure comes." And so I went on through school and didn't know what a hangover was and enjoyed it and had a good time drinking. And maybe, just maybe, I maybe my alcoholic behavior started when I got ready to graduate. I'd studied engineering, but because of my basketball ability, I was off the job coaching high school basketball down in Eastern North Carolina. And I don't know, I look back at my drinking, and there was a lot of glory in this. And I've always associated my drinking with a lot of glory. And I had to have a lot of attention. And so I began to coach high school basketball and teach high school when I was 20 years of age. Down in Eastern North Carolina, and I fell upstairs in the coaching profession in a period of about 4 years. Went to a much larger high school. I look back now, and the majority of the things that I tell you about my drinking are hindsight. A lot of the things that I found out since I've been sober. But I can remember when we used to have these weekend parties, we call them. You know, we'd meet various classmates in various cities, and, well, there were brawls. And I'd come back sometimes on Monday to go to work, and sometimes on Tuesday. I was a little bit slow in showing up, Sandy. And you begin to receive some attention if you do things like this. And it wasn't long before I began to cultivate friends in the community who drank, namely school board members that drank. And it wasn't long before I had a place to go every night to drink. Social drinking, I guess you called it. I don't know. And along about the fourth year, problems began to develop. It was in the fourth year that I was called on the carpet for the first time in the profession that I was in on account of my drinking. I began to do strange things. I began to let go of my responsibilities. I began to write checks when I didn't have money in the bank. And my good mother took care of these things for a long, long time. And it came to the point that, you know, the alcoholic begins to want to get people off his back. And I began to look for ways to get people off my back, to gain some status in the community. And so I decided I'd get married. And I courted a girl for about 2 weeks, a fine woman. And we were married. And I don't know if you've ever heard of a group honeymoon, but we had one. And we carried three other couples with us, and this is the way my first marriage began. And I remember promising that young lady that when September came that I'd stop drinking. And when September came, I couldn't stop drinking. For the first time, I realized it. For the first time, I realized I couldn't stop drinking. And then there was the pattern where my mother began to intercede, and I went to some of the best places on the East Coast. I had a lot of nervous breakdowns. And I went to these places that she was able to send me, and I'd come back in worse shape than when I went. And I struggled along through another year of teaching until eventually I was fired on account of my drinking because of the trouble I was in the community. And this wife had had enough, and she left. And everything began to fall apart. And in no time in this episode did I understand that I had a problem with drinking. It got to the point that I really thought that the problem was my mother just wasn't financing all this stuff that I was having problems with well enough. You know, if I had a little bit more green, things would be better. I wouldn't have these problems. And it got just worse and worse and worse until finally I was fired, and then later I was picked up by another school, the rock bottom of schools. As I tell my story, I just kept moving further east in my native state. And when you keep moving east in North Carolina, you wound up at the same ocean. And that's what I eventually did. In this school, I was able to last for 6 months. 6 months. And it got to the point that the only way I can describe my drinking at this time, I had to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and drink a pint. And I had it then, to drink a pint to stop shaking, so I could shave and get my clothes on and get to that school. Drive 12 miles, and invariably I knew what was going to happen at 12. The shakes would come back, and I'd have some hid in the gymnasium or in the automobile where I could take a few shots to stop the shakes. Pray for 3 o'clock when I could get back in the automobile to start back home, and then go to the beer joints and then to the store and buy enough to get stoned to the ears. And this went on for a period of about 6 months. I got totally dependent upon alcohol. I couldn't sleep unless the bottle was under the bed. I couldn't drive the automobile unless the bottle was under the seat. Totally dependent. And one day at school, the principal just stopped me and says, "Dave, you're through. We don't need you anymore." There was no big deal about this now. I wasn't called into a conference about this to discuss it. Just stopped me in the hall and says, "Give us the keys." and we don't no longer need you. And I've looked back at this time in my life many, many times, and I know today that this was the time, or prior to that, I had crossed this invisible line that we speak of an alcoholic, although I didn't know it. And this is the thing that I do not understand today. Even then, in particular, the inability of the alcoholic to see himself as he really is in his worst moments. And because of this, I was just about to die. I could not ever see myself as I really was in my worst moments. From the time I took the first drink until the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's God's truth. Oh, there were times I used to look at myself in a casual, glancing way when I was down and out and had to bargain with somebody to get something, to get out of trouble. And I used to ask myself the question, well, maybe it's the beer, maybe it's the wine, maybe it's the brand. Always in a weaker moment. But invariably, as I'd begin to get over this bout and get my health back, the liar in me would revive again, and I could not see myself as I really was. And the liar and the cheat would come about again. And I got to the point in my drinking that I could honestly deceive myself. And this is sickness. This is sickness. I had experienced blackouts before. That day I left school, I had experienced short-lived blackouts. But this day, I don't know what happened after I left school that day for a period of about 2 weeks. And I woke up in jail for the first time in my life. In the community where I was teaching school, I didn't know where I'd been or what I'd done. I later found out. But one morning, a man was talking to me through some cells. At a cell door, he later found out he was a county health doctor, and he says, son, your mother has come down here to straighten out all this mess, and we're going to help you. And I didn't know what he meant. I didn't know what he meant. Now, my mother had straightened up a lot of messes for me prior to this. And the next day, I found out where I was going for the cure, as the doctor told me. In my native state, the state insane asylum is called Dix Hill. And I've always said I, too, found my thrill on Dix Hill. That's where I went for the cure. 27 years of age. I was sent off to the insane asylum. So help me God. As long as I draw a sober breath, I hope I never forget my first trip to Dix Hill. Oh, my God, I got there, and, well, the first few days they put me in a building they called the inebriate ward, and I didn't know what that meant. And the only thing I can remember about that was, I remember the spraying treatment they gave me, where they put me in a big vat and sprayed me down. And I remember all the people that I was associated with, they had a trait for chasing squirrels. And so I became a squirrel chaser also, and I chased squirrels for about 2 weeks around that building. And then one day they put me in another building called the old Edston building, where they had a bunch of alkies. And they put me down in a place they called Skid Row, which was a padded cell. They took my clothes away from me, and they let me have my running fits. And days later, when I got through having my running fits, they gave my clothes back to me and told me to walk up and down the aisle. All I could do was walk up and down a corridor day in and day out, wondering what in the world I was doing there. And nobody talked to me about alcoholism. Nobody talked to me about why I was there. I began to look around me, and I didn't see anybody my age. And this disturbed me. The men were a lot older. I was 27 years of age. One night, I was watching these older fellows playing poker. They were using matchsticks as chips, and they began to talk, and they were in the discussion. They began to talk about the reason they were there. And I remember one man said, I'm here because my wife put me here. And then the thought crossed my mind, I'm here because dear old mother put me here. And then, of course, at one time, I had the thinking, when you're in a place like this, you begin to think strange things. At one time, I thought I was there to expose this thing to society, about a feature article for the newspapers or a book that I wasn't supposed to be there. Expose it to society. But I heard this face, and I can see that man's face tonight, today, just as I clear as I can that night, because this face, I don't know whether he's dead or alive today, but this face says, I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. And my God, when I heard that word, I thought of one thing. That was my daddy. And from that day on, I was to begin to play a game that was to plague me until Alcoholics Anonymous found me. And that game was comparing my drinking and my behavior to my father. And if the truth was really known today, my father was a much better man in his drinking than I ever hoped to be. Because my father was never kicked out of the profession he was in. He lost a family. He never had to be put into Dix Hill. And he never had to be put behind bars and confined for a long period of time. But I did. The day came that I was supposed to leave Dix Hill, and here's a man that has a college education, been some success in life, and I have nowhere to go back except back to my mother. And my mother took me in again and loved me and clothed me and fed me. And I hung around and I began to, well, the family doctor, he was ignorant of my situation, and he decided because of my history of nervous breakdowns, I needed some help, and so I don't know anything about drugs or pills, but I know a great deal about tablets. And my family doctor gave me some tablets to take, and I took these tablets faithfully for the next 9 weeks, and then I didn't have to drink. And as the old boy back at home says, I was loose as a goose most of the time, and I didn't. But one night I was in this environment with some fellows that I'd been in school with, and they were passing a bottle, and I'd been with them before and didn't need it. And I sat out to take a drink, and I took a drink, and evidently the compulsion was there because I couldn't get off of it then. And in 3 days I was back in the place I'd said I'd never go again as long as I live, Dix Hill. And to make a long story short, I went back to Dix Hill 5 times in 6 months on account of one fact. One fact, I'd become an alcoholic. I could no longer take one drink and guarantee you my behavior. And the last time I went back to Dix Hill, I was put in the nut part of the bug house instead of the drying out part. And there's a distinct difference. And I found out something about being tied down to a bed and straight jackets and how you live better electrically. I found out about that too. And I can recall a lot of it. And it seemed like a bad dream. And I can remember when I accepted my faith that I was going to die right there with these people. These people. And then a word comes into my mind this morning. You've heard it before in this meeting or this weekend. A word, coincidence. A coincidence came along. And I was put back in that old building with the rest of the alcoholics for some strange reason. And I'm one of these people that today that really believe with all my being that a higher power was working for me a long time before I ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous. A long time. And I was put back with those men, and then I'd been there so much they more or less made me an honorary attendant. I worked in the kitchen and went to get the mail, and one day three other fellows and I had just decided we'd leave. Well, I don't want to sound dramatic, but we escaped. And at that time you ran. I mean, it's not like it is today. They came after you. It was like cops and robbers, and it was a hell of a chase, and they didn't find us, and we were downtown Raleigh that night in a hotel, got kicked out of 3 hotels in a period of 4 days, and eventually I was back into my hometown, and my mother's home broke into her home. She was off in the hospital with a nervous breakdown. 2 weeks later, they bring her home and find me there, upstairs in my little room, that little bed, little boy. And they found me and decided they would get together. And when they get together, you better watch out because something's going to happen. And my God, they got together. And when I say they, I mean my two sisters, my mother, and a friend of the family has been like a father to me. And the end result was they decided that what they would do is give me a lot of money and told me to leave that part of the country. They didn't want to see me anymore. And the minute, and I knew the minute, but I began to see that all my problems were solved when they gave me that money. And it was enough money to go to the West Coast and live comfortably for a period of time, but the alcoholic. I went 4 miles to a neighboring town, pulled into a broken-down hotel and began to do the same things I'd done before. A few months later, the money ran out, and what do I do? I revert back to the same thing I'd always done before, the same pattern, writing checks. It was just a period of days before they finally caught on. And I went over home one day. I had to get some money. You know, you do anything to get money to drink. And I went over there and bought me an outboard motor. I didn't have no boat, but I bought a motor. And, you know, write a big check, get the change, pick up the motor later. And they called my mother to tell her that my motor was ready. And she began to put two and two together. And you know what happened. It was just a matter of hours before John Law was to see me again. And back to that local jail in my hometown where I'd been many, many times by then, and 3 blocks from my mother's home. And every day the sun came up, I thought she'd be down there and let me out. And she never came. She never came. One morning, I had to go upstairs and stand trial in a court of law for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. And this was unreal to me. I just didn't believe it. And you'll have to understand this scene. The city clerk was my sister. And when they called my name, she didn't seem to know who I was. No response whatsoever. The city solicitor was my mother's next door neighbor. And he didn't seem to know who I was either. And eventually they got through with me and carried me back downstairs. And then the next day they carried me to another courthouse. And I had to stand trial again for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. And to make a long story short, I eventually wound up down close to the coast in the Great Dismal Swamps. I'm ashamed of it. I've always been ashamed of it. I'm ashamed of it today. And had to be put on a chain gang. On account of one fact, I take one drink and can no longer guarantee you my behavior. And I really believe that today, and what I'm saying is for me, I really believe that it took this, and this wasn't the end, for me to eventually get to Alcoholics Anonymous. It had to be this way for me. I know a lot of people that are mighty good AA members, much better members than I, that recognize they have a problem with the booze, they put the cork in the bottle, and they come on in here and go to meetings and make mighty good members. But I wasn't that way. I had to be beat down to my knees before I could see myself as I really was. And I just about died from it. And I got to this place, and I was rather unique. I was the only man that had an education. And to get my soda pop and cigarettes, I had to write a lot of letters. And I worked harder than I've ever worked in my life. And the day came that I had to leave. Nobody would have anything to do with me anymore in my family. The day came that I had to leave. I didn't want to leave because of the shame. But you got to leave. And they carried me back to my hometown, put me out of the city limits. And I went back to the only place I could go again, back to my mother. Now, you got to understand something. My mother, by this time, was very afraid of me because, unknown to me, yet on my last drunk prior to this, I tried to take a life and didn't know nothing about it. And that day, I walked onto the back porch. She began to talk to me through a screen door. They got together again. And even my brother-in-law came over this time. And they began to talk about me. You know, you in the other room, and they're in there, and they begin to argue. And I liked this. And I heard my mother say that he stays here tonight whether you like it or not. He's my son. And I made a vow that day. I didn't know anything about the word sobriety, but I made a vow then that I wouldn't drink anymore on account of my mother. I just wouldn't drink anymore. I'd do this for her. And I don't recommend this before AA or after AA. I wasn't able to do it. And so I began to be a good feller. And I received a lot of love and a lot of attention. And then one day it was suggested maybe I should go to work. It's been a while. And I didn't think I could get a job teaching in the state of North Carolina on account of my background, what had happened to me. And so through an agency up in Virginia, through their help, I was interviewed for several jobs in five different states north of North Carolina. I went to these places. My mother carried me in a period of a 1 week, and we went to see all these people and we'd be interviewed. And I'd been sober then for about 6 months, hadn't had a drink, and things really looked good. And one afternoon, we wound up in Roanoke, Virginia. A man began to talk to me. He was the superintendent of city schools there in Roanoke, and he found out about me all in a period of about 5 minutes on the telephone about my past. And he said, "I understood you had a problem with drinking at one time. You're cured now." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Good, we want you to go to work." And so, in spite of where I'd been and what I'd done, I had a new, fresh start in life, in spite of where I'd been. I went back to my home and left the next day to come back to Roanoke to start a new life. And on the way, I rode the old Greyhound bus and had to change buses up in Virginia. And I had a little layover there, but while I was there, I decided what I'd do is have one drink. Have one drink, but about 2 pints. And this was the beginning of my last drunk, the only drunk that I really like to talk about, my last one. Because I'm the firm belief that if I forget my last one, I might have another one coming. And I never want to forget my last drunk. I don't want to forget the horror, the terror, and the loneliness that I experienced in my last drunk. When I got back to Roanoke, I didn't go to the place where I had a nice room to stay and a nice home. I had some money, plenty of clothing, and I checked into the big hotel. And I was able to stay there for a period of weeks until they had to kick me out. In the middle way of this drunk, I lost a job twice in a period of about 2 weeks. They tried to help me. In the middle way of this drunk, my mother got in touch with me over the telephone and gave me the greatest gift that I've ever received from my mother since the day I was born. And that gift was this. She kicked me out of her life. She literally kicked me out of her life. And she meant it. I knew she meant it. And it was just a few days later that after leaving this hotel, I was on the streets doing the best I could. Lost everything I had. And this went on for a period of about 24 days, so I'm told. And on Sunday, September 11th, 1957, I was sitting in a back alley down on the market in Roanoke, Virginia, with the thought of trying to get a drink of liquor down, and the thought occurred to me that I was going to die in that back alley, that I was going to die right there. And then the wonderful thought, my God, what I'm doing is what's killing me. And it's strange, the inability to see yourself as you really are. The last desperate moment. And you know, when I realized that what was happening was the liquor and the drinking, I thought of myself as a leper, the only person on God's green earth like this, in spite of where I'd been. In spite of where I'd been. And I prayed to a God I knew nothing about, somebody, please, please help me. And maybe it was a coincidence. The only man that knew me in that city found me that afternoon. I hadn't taken the drink when he found me. And that was the superintendent of the city schools in that city. And he was the man that carried me to Alcoholics Anonymous that day. He didn't know anything about AA at all. He got on the phone and called the man that knew something about AA because he had a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous that Sunday afternoon in a place they call the Easy Does It Club in downtown Roanoke, Virginia. And I never want to forget my first day as long as I live. Now, I'd gotten to the point on this last drunk that, like you, I was sick and tired of the high cost of low living. And that's what it was. And I hurt all over. My hair hurt. My toenails hurt. And I couldn't find that oblivion anymore. I couldn't black out anymore. And the day I came into AA, I didn't know where I was going, to be honest with you. But when they carried me up those steps, I was not drunk. I was weak. I couldn't get drunk anymore. It was just a state that I can't describe. But they carried me up those steps, and they got me up in the room, and we have a saying, we don't look them over, but they looked me over that day. And everything I owned was what I had on. I had 10 pennies in my pocket. And as you were looking me over on the side there, a group of them, there was an old gentleman standing in the right-hand corner. And I've never stood behind a podium that I don't mention this man. This man's name was John Tulloch. And old man John called me over to the side, and while you were looking me over, he said, "Son," says, "I want to tell you something." He says, "All you've got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. You never have to be alone again." Now, what old man John was telling me was the first few lines in chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who was thoroughly followed our path. And I knew what being alone was. And I thank God for the fact that when I got into the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, I closed it behind me and have been here ever since. Now, that old man had a lot to do. He rang my bell. Now, we hear a lot about the young alcoholic, the old alcoholic, all kinds of alcoholics. Old man John was 76 years of age when he came to AA, and he died at 82 with 6 continuous years of sobriety, and he rung my bell, and I was 29 when I got here. I've never forgotten him. Well, after you got through looking me over, they began to talk to me a little. And I began to shake. And I began to ask some questions. And I really didn't know where I was or what was going to happen. And I asked them, could I get a drink? And they said, "No, we don't do it that way." Said, "If you get too bad, we're going to get a doctor for you." Then I asked them, well, I started a revolution. I asked them for some tablets. And they said, "No, no tablets. No tablets." And they said, "Drink some of that coffee. Drink some of that coffee." And what I'm about to say is no reflection on the committee, but I've always contended, and I still contend, there are a hell of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee that ain't got no business doing it. And this was one of those days. They said, "Drink that coffee," and there was that ropey stuff that, you know, my God, and I thought that was a requirement. You had to drink it to stay. And so I began to drink that coffee. And that night they carried me to my first meeting at the old central group. And I remember a little of the meeting. I remember that I wanted to jump out the window. And I remember sitting under my hands. But I remember most of all what this whole program is about. When some people walked up to me who were complete strangers, and I was a stranger to them, and they put their arm around me, and said, "We love you, and we understand, and you're going to be all right." And that's all we got to offer a drunk when he walks in that door, is love and understanding. I really believe that I was love sober. My sickness was right here. I believe I was love sober. And I didn't know it at that time, but they loved me sober. And, you know, I sat there at the meeting, and we got ready to leave, and then it was proved to me that night. I want to make a point of this. It was proved to me that night that I didn't have to be alone anymore. Many people have asked me, "How did you get sober? How did you get off the bottle?" I'll tell you how I got off of it. As I got ready to leave that meeting, these people were standing around, and 3 men came up to me and said, "Dave," says, "we're going to be with you all night long. We got you a room at the Y, and we're going to stay with you. And we're not going to nurse you, but we're going to stay with you and talk to you about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And we went up to that Y, and I began to shake, and I began to hurt. And they began to make some promises to me that everything would be all right, a simple promise. Everything would be all right if I wouldn't take a drink for the next minute. And then the next hour. And they took turns sitting on top of me. And next morning the sun came up, and old Claude, Claude's dead now, I helped bury him. Claude, I've never forgotten it. He said, "Dave," says, "you made so many hours." And you know, I really began to believe right then that maybe, just maybe, the hope began that maybe I could make it this one day. Just one day. And then they carried me back down to that club room that morning, and And I was introduced to the man who has become my first sponsor. A man that had that unique ability to talk to me on my level of understanding. I've never forgotten my first conversation with him. He began to ask me a lot of questions. Do you have a job? Where'd you come from? Do you have any checks out? I didn't know how he knew that, and I did have some. Now, he asked me some pointed questions, and every reply I gave was a negative answer, and in the total summation after we got through, well, he says, it seems to me you're not doing so hot. And, you know, I began to think, as you do when you begin to look at yourself, well, I was not doing so hot. And he says, well, I suggest that what you're going to have to do is do certain things. And, you know, one of the strangest things, I can remember that day, a lot of expressions in my early age that it still ring a bell, and it might seem silly to some people, but I remember them talking about cold turkey, getting sober cold turkey. And I can remember, well, how in the hell can sliced cold turkey help me get over a drunk? Things like that, and you're not doing so hot. And then you're going to have to make some amends. Now, you're talking about making amends. I made amends my second day sober. He was talking to me about these bad checks, and I had some out at that big hotel, $1,800 worth. And he says, well, we're going to see them tomorrow and get that straight. And right then I knew, I should have found this thing years ago. They take care of these bad checks, you know. And I had to go see that man the next day, the manager of that big hotel that sits up on that hill. And I never forgot the experience. I sat down and told him who I was. He knew who I was when I walked in the door. And I said, what they told me to say, I'm an alcoholic. I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll pay you back when I can, but I'm just trying to stay sober one day at a time. And that man told me something I couldn't believe. He said, well, if you're willing to help yourself, we're willing to help you too. Don't you worry about that. And this man became one of my greatest friends. My greatest friends. And I had to go to two other places that same day, that second day, and make the same amendment about some of these things, bad chicks. And they told me the same thing. And so I began to have some hope. And then I'd been sober for a few days, and then they put me in a boarding house, and I'm in a home where six other alcoholic men lived that had a room. And I've never stood behind this podium again that I don't mention these six men, because they gave me much. Out of those six men, I helped bury two of them on account of going back to drinking. They didn't think they needed meetings anymore. Two of them are drinking today, and two of them are sober. And they gave me much. And so I began to rock along, and it wasn't long before I met my present wife, Sue, whom some of you know, and this was another coincidence. A coincidence, a gift from God as far as I'm concerned. And things began to get better, and then I was having this employment problem. And, you know, I was one of these people who had to get dumb when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to get dumb. And most of the things I've learned in this program has been from people with less education than I. And my employment problem was solved one night with a man with a third grade education. His name was Red. He was a sign painter. And, in that group, you talked about your problem. And my problem was that I didn't have a job. Been sober about 6 months. And we were sitting around the table talking about this, and Red says, Dave, it seems to me that if you studied engineering in college, that's what you ought to be doing in life. And, hell, nobody ever explained it to me that way. And so I made sense. And so through Red's efforts and Sue's efforts, I went to the Virginia Highway Department and told the truth again. And my God, there's no resistance against the truth. And this man sat there in complete amazement and told me the same thing. We're willing to help you if you're willing to help yourself. And I was to begin a career that I'm presently in, which is the same thing in the state of North Carolina. And things got better. Things really got better. And I got physically, I got dry. Began to get a little green on my hip. And it wasn't long before people in the group would notice me, begin to speak to me a little. And I got some nice clothes, and things were getting better. And then I had some aspirations about finally in my group. Now, you talking about a steering committee. Oh, I caused a revolution one time. I invited a fellow from out of town and didn't go through the steering committee. They just met on everything. And finally, they let me talk one night. I'd been sober about 9 months. And, of course, where I'd living in this boarding house, one of the men had gotten drunk, and my talk was dedicated to him. I never heard of one, but I gave one night on how not to slip. Really and truly, if there's anybody back there today or anywhere that has any thoughts about asking me to sit down, hell, I've trained this way. They started asking me to sit down when I was talking years ago, and it happened that day because I'd been going on about 20 minutes with this talk, and I heard somebody say, sit down. And, you know, you don't hear them. And I just kept going, and by God, he got up from the chair, came to the podium, took me by the arm, and says, I said, sit down, right in front of everybody. And he took me back to my seat now. The seats. You know how groups, within groups, how they are structured. The old timers sat on the back row. We call it humility row. And guess who always sat with them? I was 9 months sober, and hell, I was sitting with them, you know. And he took me back to my seat on humility row and sat me down. And you know, truthfully, the thought I had as I was going back to my seat was, I got a little bit too much power for him tonight. He don't want me to overdo it. That's all it is. And so I sat down, and after the meeting, one of the old-timers came up to me and began to tell me some things. And, you know, my God, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the old-timer. When they begin to talk to you and tell you something, you take it as a compliment in the beginning. After you leave them, about 5 minutes later, you begin to think, and hell, it ain't a compliment at all. And this old timer says, after he set me down to all this ritual, he said, Dave says, you know something? At the rate you're going, you're going to be the governor of Virginia in 6 months. And hell, I believed him. I'd believe anything. So I was beginning to experience these things that we experienced, and things were getting better, and I was doing pretty good in my job, but I got to a point after about a little over a year, that I began to listen to some people with bad news for me. Because I got in this environment, and it's here. It's here. Not necessarily right here in this room, but it's here. It's in the fellowship. This environment where some people begin to talk about, you know, just take what you want and throw the rest away. And no man has ever had a better foundation on these 12 steps than I did in my early sobriety. But I began to be around these people. And I began to do strange things, and I began to think like they did. And it wasn't long before I got to the point, I can remember sitting in the back of the room many a night after about a year of sobriety and started gritting my teeth. I didn't want to be there. And a guy was up here pouring out his heart. And I'd sit there telling myself, hell, I can make a better talk drunk than he can sober. Things like that. And it wasn't long before I found myself, I was willing to go 200 or 300 miles to make a talk at a group. But I couldn't go 3 blocks to my home group to listen to anybody else. And when you get like this, you're sick. And I got sick. And thank God. Not the fact of the responsibility, not only the responsibility, but they had the guts to see what was happening to me, and they told me about it. They called me in one day and sat me down, 6 other men and my sponsor, at a table, and told me what was going to happen to me unless I started doing certain things. After I'd been sober about a year and a half. And now this is a heck of a thing to tell the backbone of the group that he's going to get drunk. And that's what they told me. Said, you're going to get drunk unless you start doing certain things. And you got to get a hold of these steps and start trying to work them if you want to stay sober and be somebody. And my God, I got mad. I was hurt. I resented them. And, I went back to that boarding house, shut the door, and I wanted to get back. I didn't have a thought of taking a drink or anything like that, but I wanted to get back at them. I wanted to hurt them. You know how we do. And so I decided what I'd do. I'd send them a written resignation. I'd just resign from Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, prior to leaving that room, my sponsor had told me something I hope I never forget as long as I live. As I was getting ready to go out the door, he said, "Dave, I want to ask you one question before you shut that door." I said, "What is it?" He said, "When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety?" And I got back in that room when I was beginning to write this manuscript, and I kept hearing it. It was like an echo. It kept ringing. "When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety?" It kept ringing in my ear. And eventually, I was forced to get down on my knees and pray to a God I knew nothing about even after being sober a year and a half. God, to me, was a question mark in the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. But I prayed for some help. And the end result of that simple prayer was I was able to go in a bathroom and look at myself for the first time in my life in a mirror and know what I really was. That I was just a speck on this universe, was born into the world, and someday I'll die and soon be forgotten. And if I wanted to stay sober, the only way I had to go was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never forgot. And the next night, I went back to that group, and I rejoined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've rejoined 19 times since then. And it works for me. And I became, as my good friend Barry says, I became a member of the clique in AA. And if you want to know what the click is, you get to the meeting sometimes and see who does the work. I started making coffee and setting out those chairs. And after the meeting was over, I stayed there and started doing these things that has to be done. And things got better. Things got better. And I got into these steps just like they told me to do. And I began to have some hope. And some hope led to some faith. And things really did get better. And it was along about this time that I had the opportunity to come back to the state of North Carolina, mainly for the reason of getting a divorce so I can marry Sue. And my first sponsor turned me over to a man who was traveling that area, who lived in Raleigh. There's a lot of people in this room that knew him. And his name was Tom Burrell, one of the early members in New York. And Tom was living in Raleigh, and he promised Jack that he would sponsor me when I got to Raleigh, and he did. And this man gave me much. He gave me much. Tom was a man that rammed the big book down my throat. Because I was one of these people, even after a year and a half or 2 years sobriety, that I would ask you questions to let you know how smart I was. And Tom would say, "Read the book and then we'll talk. Read the book and then we'll talk." And he's the man that got me interested in service. Because I didn't know anything about New York and GSO. And I began to be in another environment, kind of taking a knock at GSO. And one night I had some profound statements to make about it, although I didn't know what I was talking about it. And Tom handed me an old blue book called The Third Legacy Manual. He says, "Read this and don't you ever knock anything in Alcoholics Anonymous until you know something about it." And I was intrigued and I got interested in service work. And he had a lot to do with it. And this man gave me much. And he gave me about standing behind one of these things right here this morning. He gave me a great lesson in this. Or after I'd been sober about 4 years, I began to travel around a little and go to these conventions and retreats and conferences. And I began to watch these people standing up here talking. And as I sat there, you know, I saw them after the meeting was over, a big applause and hugging and kissing. And I began to have some thinking, you know, well, I believe I can do that. And so one night after the meeting was over, I told Tom prior to the meeting that I wanted to talk to him about something. I had a problem. So after the meeting was over, we went into the little ante room to the group room, and he sat me down. Now, he was one of these people that always made you sit down. He stood up, and he talked down at you. And he said, "What's the problem?" And I told him, I said, "Tom, I think I'm a convention speaker." And he said, "Well, I can't repeat what he did say." But the agreement was that morning, or that night rather, that from that time on, any time I spoke in the group, he would let me know when. And this was when I really believe it was when I was 5 years sober. 8 years sober. This is the truth. 8 years sober, he called me over to his house one day, said, bring Sue with you. And says, I want to talk to you about something. I got over there, and he says, Dave, says, you're going down to Columbia, South Carolina to talk at the state convention. You do this, you do that, you do this, you do that. And then he says this. Before you go, there's something I want to tell you. He says, you're going as a damn substitute, and don't you ever forget it as long as you live. And I really, truly believe, and I'm getting more reluctant to stand behind one of these things, but as I stand up here this morning, and every time I get up, I just feel like, well, by God, I'm just substituting. And it works for me, and he gave me much. There might be someone here this morning that was like I was after I'd been sober about a year and a half, that begins to fight with yourself or quarrel with yourself about this program. Begin to have this looking for this mystery of sobriety and what it's all about. Begin to wonder what we're talking about when we speak of living problems. And really, truly, when you think about it, it's just a living program for living problems. And I was no different. But it might be someone here this morning that was just like I was. If there is, the only advice I'd have to offer is this, that you got to really get in this program and get a hold of one word, and that's the truth. Because I really believe that the core and guts of Alcoholics Anonymous is based on one word, the truth. Or more briefly, you got to be honest with yourself. I heard it said many years ago somewhere by somebody in AA that when Jesus Christ walked through the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, I'm a truthful man. He said, I am the truth. I believe that it's from this source and this root that we inherited this wonderful program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've seen enough in my time in AA not only to believe, but to know that there is a power behind this universe that stands ready to help you and I if we're willing to help ourselves. A lot of my friends, when I first came in, called it the man upstairs. Today I choose to call it God. The God of my understanding that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Simply by your love for me. It took a long, long time for my mother ever to accept me back in her life. The first time she saw me was after I'd been sober 3 years, and she didn't believe it. And she didn't understand how I could do this for a bunch of strangers, and I could never do it for her. And then once we did establish contact, we got to the point that we couldn't be in each other's presence for some strange reason. My sponsor tried. I tried. My wife tried. Everybody tried. And God does work in mysterious ways. I was 9.5 years sober, and I was invited down one of these local meetings in my hometown to at an intergroup meeting, and my mother wouldn't come to the meeting to hear me. And unbeknownst to me, there were some friends of hers, some old ladies that knew me when I was a little boy, that decided they'd go see what I'd done about my life. And they came to that meeting. And I went on back to Raleigh that night, and the phone rang about 9:00, and it was my mother. And these old ladies had gone to my mother's home and set her down and told her about me. In the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night, my mother asked me to forgive her for what she'd done to me in my sobriety. In spite of what I'd done to her trying to find sobriety. And this happens nowhere except in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she thinks AA is the best thing on the face of the earth right today. She knows where I am right now. She asked me a lot of questions. And I'd been sober about 5 years when she asked me that question, and you probably have been asked the same thing. You've been sober 5 years. Haven't you learned a thing? Why do you have to keep on going, going, going? In spite of this God-given sobriety, I've come to know there are certain things I have to do. And the first thing I have to do is I have to continue to have a monumental desire to stay sober. I have to continue to have a monumental desire to stay sober, to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I first came in that first day, I promised you that I was willing to go to any length to get this program. And sometimes today I have to do the same thing. And sometimes it happens at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when the phone rings and there's somebody wanting some help. Maybe a new person, maybe an old one, but wants some help, somebody to talk to. And the thought occurs to me, well, maybe he can wait till after breakfast. And thank God, the next thought is this. Those three men that first night didn't say, we'll be back after breakfast. No. Be willing to go to any length to get this program. And the second thing I have to do is I have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like Sandy was talking about last night, check your drinking. Also, check your going to meetings. I think these conferences, these retreats, and all these get-togethers are wonderful things. That's icing on the cake. But if this is where you get your AA, you better go back home and inventory your home group, because that's where I get mine. I wouldn't be here today standing before you if it wasn't for my home group. I feel like they allow me the privilege to be here. I'm in good standing, I think. And they know what I am because they sit down and share with me on eyeball to eyeball, and they know what makes me tick. And the greatest gift they've given me is to try to walk like I talk. The most priceless possession that you and I have is the love of our home group. You can go there when you can't go anybody anywhere else, and they understand. Good or bad, they understand. And you know, it's always the little people in the group that I hang on to. There's a couple in my group that I've been sponsoring, it seems like, for eternity. They're man and wife. I know it's unheard of, but I'm doing it. She's got 8 years sobriety now, and he's got 6. He should have 25. Vernon and Gertrude. And just to be around these two people, hell, you have to stay sober. Several years ago, one Christmas Eve night, we were at the step meeting night, and wasn't many people there. They let me lead the meeting that night on the 8th step. It was Christmas Eve night. There wasn't many people there. And after the meeting, we decided we'd go somewhere and get us a cup of coffee and a sandwich. And Gertrude and Vernon, neither one of them had any driver's license in. And they got in the car. We were riding down the street. And Gertrude said to Vernon, said, we'd been talking about the 8th step now. Vernon, when are you going to make some amends to me? Just right out. When are you going to make some amends to me? And I've never forgotten Vernon. He said, hell, Gertrude, you're not even on my list. Any minute. Yeah, it's people like this I have to be around. So you got to go to those meetings because that's where all the action is. And the third thing I have to do is I have to try to work these 12 steps to the best of my ability. These steps, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as far as I'm personally concerned and as far as AA is concerned. Because I've happened to be reminded this morning of a line in the big book. It says, we're granted a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I happen to know that it's for this alcoholic that my spiritual condition is much improved since I've been trying to work these 12 steps to the best of my ability. Oh, there's a person I'd like for you to see in me, and then there's a person you probably see in me. But there's a person I see in myself, and that's what the whole ball game's about. I got to learn how to love me and be with me. And it's through these steps that I've been able to make some inroads to this sobriety and accomplish this fact. And the fourth thing I have to do is some days I just have to hang on and do the best I can. Just hang on and do the best I can, because Tom told me many years ago that nothing's so bad that it will not get better if you just hang on and do what you're supposed to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You just hang on. Be a member. be a member. Coincidence. You know, you've had a beautiful weekend this weekend. Your programs have been tremendous. I didn't have the opportunity to hear Earl Thursday night, but I know Earl and I know what he stands for. And then Lois, just walking in. The wife of a co-founder. The mother superior of Al-Anon. Just a coincidence? A coincidence that I'm here this morning and see so many of my friends that have led me through sobriety and given me the right things in life. Well, if it is a coincidence, I simply define a coincidence as an act of God in the midst of time. That same God that has been doing for you and I is that which we could not do for ourselves. God, the Father of all mankind. The greatest thing that has ever happened to me is Alcoholics Anonymous. And the longer I stay sober, the greater it becomes. Thank you very much.